with the discussion of this key equation to discriminative training, where we have the we have things in terms of the entropy of omega minus the mutual information between omega and x. And we talked about the fact that the minimization of h of omega corresponds to finding prior probabilities that minimize entropy. And this amounts to accurate prediction of the class labels from prior information. So that's essentially our priors. And in an application like speech recognition, this involves estimating the probabilities of word sequences, which we can gather from offline data, such as looking out over the internet or looking through a lot of written materials and such. Alternately, we can estimate parameters of a model that minimize the that maximize the mutual information, and this is referred to as maximum mutual information estimation, and that's done by maximizing this term, which will then minimize the negative of that term. So what we want to do today is to explore this in a little more detail. So to do that, we're going to need to go back to our Bayesian estimation. So the decision rule for minimum error rate classifier selects the class omega sub I with the maximum posterior probability P of omega sub I given X. And this is a formulation we've been working on throughout most of the semester. So if we recall Bayes' rule, we can write the posterior P of omega sub I given X as the likelihood P of X given omega sub I times the prior P of omega sub I divided by P of X. The evidence P of X can be expressed as a sum over all the classes of P of X given omega sub I times P of omega sub I. And as we've discussed, we can ignore P of X since it is constant with respect to the maximization. However, during training, and this is one of the key distinctions between discriminative training and maximum likelihood training, the value of P of X depends on the parameters of all models and varies as a function of X. And therefore, what we're going to try to do in discriminative training is to not just adjust the most likely the parameters for the model associated with the most likely class, we're also going to try to adjust the parameters of the model associated with the alternate classes and try to minimize the probability that the test vector came from those alternate classes. So a conditional maximum likelihood estimator, which we'll call theta star CMLE, is defined as the maximum of the posterior with respect to X. From the previous slide, we can invoke mutual information, and we can write that the mutual information between X and omega is the sum over X, the sum over omega of P of X and omega, the joint distribution, times the log of the joint distribution divided by the marginal distribution. However, if application of this is a problem because we don't know this joint distribution between X and omega. So we need to think of a clever way to work around that. So we're going to define the instantaneous mutual information I of between X and omega sub I, the class assignment, as the log of P of X and omega sub I over P of X and P of omega sub I. So this is a mutual information with respect to a particular class omega sub I. If we assume equal priors, then maximizing the conditional likelihood is equivalent to maximizing the instantaneous mutual information. And this is what we refer to as the MMIE approach. This is what how the approach has been applied in the literature. So we can expand I of X and omega sub I into two terms, one representing the correct class and the other representing the incorrect class with our competing models. So we can write that P of X is equal to P of X given omega sub I times P of omega sub I. This is the correct class plus the sum of the contributions from the incorrect classes. The posterior probability P of omega sub I given X can be rewritten as, again, using Bayes' rule, P of X given omega sub I, P of omega sub I, divided by this term, the sum for the correct class and the sum for the, and then the correct class rather, plus the sum for the incorrect classes. So maximization of the posterior, which is this, implies we need to reinforce the correct model. We need to drive this term as high as possible and minimize the contribution from the competing models, which is to drive this term as low as possible. Now, we can further rewrite this just by dividing through by the numerator. We can write this in a form of 1 over 1 plus alpha, and then we see directly that maximizing this implies maximizing this ratio, so we essentially minimize the denominator. So this illustrates a fundamental difference between MLE and MMIE. Only with MLE, only the correct model needs to be updated during training, while MMIE, every model is going to be updated during training. Now, what's the drawback of that approach? So that in conceptually, that's a nice approach, but what does that require? There's sort of two drawbacks to this approach. What kind of information are we going to need to be able to update the correct class and to basically update all of the competing models? Why? Very good point.
The automatic fundamental. We need to separate those two and calculate every time.
Right. So if there's a large number of alternative classes, this if the computational effort in doing the MLE approach is N or whatever, then if you have 100 models, the computational cost of the discriminative training could be 100 times N. So it's very expensive computationally. What about actually finding these? If you think about forward-backward algorithm, what about finding these alternative classes? Where are they going to come from? So if you remember when we talked about HMMs, we talked about forward-backward training, we always assumed the most probable model was the correct model. We never actually had to search for the incorrect, the next best choices, you could say. And that's another problem with this approach, is you need to somehow know what the alternative choices are for your hypothesis. And in a large application like a speech recognition system, that in itself is a big problem because you have a very large search space to consider. So the greater the prior probability, and we'll talk a little bit more about those issues shortly, but the greater the prior probability of a completing class label, the greater its contribution to the MMIE model. And that makes sense, since the chance of misrecognizing the input as this class is greater. Though it might appear MMIE and MLE are related, they will produce different solutions for finite amounts of training data. However, they should converge in the limit for infinite amounts of training data. And that's another sort of important observation, that as you get more and more data about your problem space, then the difference between MMIE and MLE decreases. The principal difference is that in MMIE, we decrement the likelihood of the competing models, while in MLE, we only reinforce the correct model. MMIE, however, is computationally very expensive and lacks an efficient maximization algorithm. Instead, we must use gradient descent, and we'll talk about that now. So, we have developed pretty good techniques for doing MMIE estimation, but it's an iterative process. There's no closed-form solution. So we will define our optimization problem as minimization of this term. That was based on the equation we talked about in the previous slide. Now, no closed-form solution exists for minimization of this. So we're going to instead use an iterative approach where we try to update the parameters based on a term proportional to the derivative and such. And that's essentially a fairly well-known thing to do. If you study, in the adaptive signal processing class, we talk extensively about these kinds of iterative approximations. So that we can apply this kind of approach directly to the HMM training. In HMM training, if you remember, the objective function that we're trying to maximize is actually a ratio of rational function. And the original Baum-Welsch algorithm requires that the objective function be a homogeneous polynomial. Don't worry about that too much. What I mainly want to say here is that when you see people talk about discriminative training, you'll hear them talk about the extended Baum-Welsch algorithm. And this was developed for use on rational functions and applied to continuous density HMM systems based on this approximation and this optimization problem. So when people talk about discriminative training in an HMM context, you'll often see them saying, well, we applied the extended Baum-Welsch algorithm. And the principal difference there is that it's a way of integrating this gradient descent into the optimization problem. And I won't go through the derivations here because they're rather tedious. But what's interesting is they have a fairly simple interpretation in the case of the Gaussian mixture model. The re-estimation formulae for mean and diagonal covariances have been developed. If we consider at a state J and a mixture component M. So we have a Gaussian mixture model, and if we ask the question, what does it take to update the mean and covariance of the Mth component of the mixture model at state J, you can actually work through this and derive some fairly simple re-estimation equations where the new mean, that's at state J for the Mth mixture coefficient, is equal to this theta numerator minus theta denominator plus D times the old mean divided by your gammas, what we call gamma numerator minus gamma denominator plus D. Now, let me explain in a second. I'll explain where all these things come from. But we have a similar expression for the variance. Remember, this is only true for the diagonal covariance. The expressions for full covariance do not exist in a simple state like this. But for the diagonal variance, you have a similar situation. You have this term, theta numerator minus theta denominator, but now this is of the variance plus some weight times a term related to the old covariance divided by this denominator term. Now, there are a couple things going on here. One is this term theta j, sub jm of an observation is defined as it's a weighted average of the observations based on the gamma probabilities that we introduced in Baum-Welsch training. If you remember, in the Baum-Welsch training, we had the alphas and betas, and then we derived from them the gammas. And the gammas represent these posterior probabilities. And this theta numerator minus theta denominator, theta numerator is essentially the maximum likelihood component of this expression, which is related to the correct class times the prior. Theta denominator is essentially the term related to the alternate classes. So what we're going to try to do in this iteration is we're going to try to derive the ML probabilities high and decrease the probabilities of the competing models. And we're going to then essentially re-estimate the means in terms of the difference between those plus some contribution from the previous mean. So let's think about this for a moment. If these two terms are equal, then all we have here essentially is the new mean is equal to the old mean. Okay, now what does it mean for these two terms to be equal? Well, if the maximum likelihood solution and the discriminative solution are essentially producing the same result, that means the correct class and the incorrect classes look about the same. And there's nothing you can really do about that, right? So you just say, well, let me just go then with my new estimate of the mean is going to be equal to my old estimate of the mean. But as you drive the ML solution high and the alternate incorrect choices low, then you start to weight this contribution more heavily. And then on top of that, you have a constant which lets you weight control the amount the weight between the old solution and the new solution. So what this is doing is it's giving you a way of, this is actually a result of this kind of an iterative solution to the optimization problem, but it's giving you a way of controlling how much weight you give to the discriminative training parts compared to the traditional parts. So typically what we do with discriminative training is we will do a few passes of maximum likelihood training. That gives us, you could say, the mu sub JM. And then we'll do a few passes of discriminative training. In discriminative training now, you're adjusting the model so that you, in addition to increasing the likelihood of the correct choice, you're adjusting the model to decrease the likelihood of the competing model. And that's done by this equation. And you do this across all of the means for all of the components. Now, some of the states J will correspond to the correct choice, and some of the states for J will correspond to the incorrect choices. So the thing that's not shown here explicitly is that to do these calculations, you need to know which states correspond to the correct choices and which states correspond to the incorrect choices, because this update will be done with respect to the incorrect choices. So there's a lot of details associated with this that we won't talk about, but you've got links on the front page to the papers the seminal papers on this work. But the interesting thing about discriminative training, it took about 10 years to get to the point where we understood how to do this in a rigorous way. And the interesting thing about it is it's posed in a recursion that's very similar to the way the standard Baum-Welsh works. The only difference is you need to keep information about the incorrect choices. And I think I have a slide. Yeah, about that. So mixture coefficients and transitional probabilities are a little harder to estimate using discriminative training and have not showed significant improvements in performance. It's possible to derive an equation to estimate any parameter of your system using discriminative training. But traditionally, in the hidden Markov model framework, we only estimate observation probabilities. We don't typically estimate transition probabilities and mixture coefficients. Similarly, it's possible to integrate mixture splitting into discriminative training, but that's provided only marginal gains as well. There are various strategies for estimating the learning parameter D and making this specific to the mixture component and the state. The papers that I point you to discuss that in more detail. I don't want to go into that level of detail in this class, but it's possible to have that adaptation constant be specific to a state and a Gaussian mixture. Now, calculation of the Gaussian occupancies, which is the probability of being in state J and component M summed over all time, is required. These are the gammas. And in MLE training, these quantities are calculated for each training observation using the forward-backward algorithm. For MMI training, we need counts for the correct model, the numerator, and all competing models, the denominator. The latter is extremely expensive and has been the subject of much research. The preferred approach is to use a lattice to approximate the calculation of the probability of the competing model. So when the first work on discriminative training in an HMM framework was presented, people took a system that needed maybe on the order of about 10 megabytes, let's say 10 to 50 megabytes to store the forward-backward algorithm information, and let's say ran in maybe a few days worth of compute time. And to do the updating of the incorrect models, that ran the system from a few days of compute time to a year of compute time. So they were running this on very large clusters initially because they, you know, significant increase in compute time. More interestingly, the amount of memory that you needed, you need to store all these alternate choices, that took the system from 50 megabytes of information to over a gigabyte of information. Because now you had to keep track of these things we call lattices, which are essentially all possible alternate choices at all possible times. It's a detail that's somewhat specific to speech recognition, but to do discriminative training, you need a list. You need some representation of the alternate choices, the choices that could have been chosen if their probabilities were higher. Now, in a static classification problem where you just have input vectors and you have class assignments, this is really easy to do because you don't have to worry about when particular input vectors happened in the input signal. But in problems like speech recognition or any kind of time series analysis, you not only have to worry about the alternate choices involve not just the alternate class choices, but also where they occurred in time. Because if you remember with HMM training, we do segmentation as part of the training process. So the reason these lattices are so big is because they have to hold all possible alternatives for all possible time. So for time series analysis, it's a bit of a trick to implement this. Fortunately, we've worked on this now for about 15 years in speech recognition, and we have pretty good ways of doing this. Not trivial, but we know how to do this. For static pattern classification problems, it's a much easier process because if you have n classes, then the alternate choices are just n minus 1, and it's fairly simple to do. But the main thing I want you to get out of this section of the lecture is that the discriminative training framework essentially sits on top of the maximum likelihood training and more or less involves adjusting parameters of the alternate choice models as well as parameters of the correct choice model. So it's a nice extension to the ML process. Now, the parameter estimation technique, but that's not the end of the story. There's actually other ways we can do discriminative training. And one thing that we've done here at Mississippi State many years ago was we actually used support vector machines at each state, which are purely discriminative type classifiers. So we trained, a purely discriminative model. And it gave us a slight improvement performance. And since then, many people have adopted support vector machines. But it wasn't as big an advance as we'd hoped. But there are other ways to do discriminative training. Parameter estimation techniques discussed thus far seek to maximize the likelihood function or the posterior probability. Recall early in the course, we discussed the possibility of directly maximizing the probability of error, P of E, or what we call Bayes' risk, which is known as minimum error rate estimation. But a complete or closed-form solution to this problem is often intractable. Minimum error rate classification is also known as minimum classification error. Similar to MMIE, the algorithm tests the classifier using re-estimated models, reinforces the correct models, and suppresses the incorrect models. In MMIE, we use the posterior, P of omega sub I given x, as a discriminant function. However, any valid discriminant function can be used for this kind of training. Minimum error rate estimation was first introduced to hidden Markov models back in the mid-80s using a heuristic approach based on a very simple indicator function where you simply counted the number of errors associated with a particular model. So let's denote a family of these discriminant functions as d sub I of x, one for each class. To find an alternate smooth error function for MCE, assume the discriminant family contains s discriminant functions. So we have s of these discriminant functions. And we can attempt to minimize the error rate directly by defining the error as a function of these discriminant functions for the correct class and the discriminant functions for the incorrect class. And we talked a little bit earlier about raising this to the nth power, but essentially this is just a function which takes the goodness of the correct class and balances it with the goodness of the incorrect classes, and then you can weight how much attention you give to the incorrect classes by that constant eta. So E sub I of x greater than or equal to 0 implies a recognition error, and E sub I of x less than or equal to 0 implies a correct recognition. That's simply saying that if this term dominates this term, then it looks like the correct model is the right choice. If this term dominates this term, then it looks like you might not have a very good model. Eta is a positive learning constant that controls how we weight the competing classes. When eta goes to infinity, the competing class score becomes the maximum score of any one class. And eta equals 1 implies the average score for all competing classes is used. So that gives you a little bit of insight into how eta influences this process. So in the limit, if you make eta very large, your minimum error rate training is going to essentially seek to minimize the probability of the most likely or highest discriminant function. Now, to be able to differentiate this thing, we're going to embed this error function in a sigmoid distribution. This is a common approximation that's done in a number of neural network type approaches. Sigmoid functions are nice because they have this property of being bounded between 1 and minus 1. So this is a formulation that will often be used when you need a function that's differentiable. So this L sub I of x and theta is essentially a soft recognition error count, meaning that instead of counting errors as ones or zeros, you now have a function which is sort of smooth between those states, and you can differentiate it. The recognizer's loss function then can be defined as the expectation of this loss function, which is simply the sum over the S classes of the loss function times a delta function, which is 1 when you have the correct class and 0 when you have the incorrect class. And since the maximum of this of the integral of a function is equal to the integral of the maximum of a function when the function is of this form, we can optimize these functions directly instead of jointly optimizing all of them. Nevertheless, again, we can rarely solve this problem analytically, and instead must use gradient descent. So we actually invoke a gradient descent type algorithm, very, very similar to what we do in MMIE. But in fact, the MCE solution is more computationally expensive than MMIE, though I won't show you that in great detail. But so the main point here that I want you to understand is that it's possible to, instead of working with likelihoods, where we say, well, this pattern with some probability could have been associated with any of these classes, another approach would be to take the data, recognize it with the models, and because you know the truth, you have truth markings on the data, you know what the true class assignment for the data is. So if the model correctly recognizes the data, you sort of increment your counts by 1. So you have this data, you have this model, and you know the true class associated with that data. Okay, so let's go back to our example of sea bass and salmon. So you take a measurement and you feed it into the system. The system says it's a sea bass. Well, if in fact that pattern corresponded to sea bass, You say, well, that's good. The model correctly recognized the data. So let me reward the model for that by adjusting the parameters of the model to increase that the likelihood of the data given the model. And I'm going to adjust only the parameters of the correct model because the correct model was the most probable model. But what you can also do is take the incorrect classes, recognize it with that pattern, and adjust the model parameters so you decrease the probabilities of these incorrect classes. Now that's essentially, in a nutshell, the concept behind discriminative training. There are several ways to implement that. What we're proposing here is, rather than work with the likelihood, we're actually working with the recognition errors directly, so to speak, so that we guarantee that whether the model is more likely or not, we don't really care. But what we guarantee with this approach is that the error rate is going to be lower because it's directly minimizing the error rate. But you can't differentiate an error rate because it's a one or zero type function. Either it made an error or it didn't. So it has to be cast in this manner that lends itself to some kind of iterative optimization process. And that's sort of what this is outlining here. So the gradient descent approach is often referred to as generalized probabilistic descent, GPD, and you'll see this in the literature, so I wanted you to be familiar with that term. A simpler, more pragmatic approach to discriminative training is something called corrective training. In corrective training, a labeled training set is used to train parameters using MLE. A list of confusable or near-miss classes is generated, using NBEST lists, using lattices, or just using simple indicators if it's a simple classification problem. The parameters of the models corresponding to correct classes are reinforced. Parameters of the confusion classes are decremented. And this is actually easy to do in Baumwald's training because the counts are accumulated. So what was initially done with corrective training was nothing more than take these gammas that you generate during HMM training and boost them when you made a correct recognition and decrement them when you made an incorrect recognition. Very, very simple, and actually was fairly effective. And then this was introduced first, and then later this was generalized into MMIE and MCE. Now, neural networks offer an alternative to these approaches because with a neural network, you actually explicitly reward the model for correct choices, and you adjust the parameters of the model to decrease the incorrect choices. That's an explicit part of neural network training, and that's why neural networks became very popular in the mid-80s, because they were a purely discriminative approach. They're one of the first, you could say, complete iterative solutions to this kind of problem. Unfortunately, neural networks as an architecture were not as effective on problems like time series analysis, like speech recognition and such. So people looked for ways to do discriminative training within the HMM framework, and that's really what generated the MMIE and MCE approaches, so that you could combine the power of the HMM with the power of discriminative training. And that combination generally does, I would say, for problems like speech recognition, generally does better than the neural network approach. It's not so much that one or the other is worse at discriminative training, it's that the HMM is more amenable to problems like speech recognition. Now, the interesting thing about discriminative training, and again, I think this is a good example of the engineering aspects of signal processing, once somebody comes up with one of these algorithms, then immediately you see thousands of publications where people apply this to every aspect of the problem. So for the past few years, people have actually applied this to every parameter associated with a speech recognition system, including the feature vectors themselves. So if, for example, you're using a principal components analysis in your feature vector, you're taking your features, and transforming them by some whitening or some linear transformation, you can actually optimize the parameters of that linear transformation using discriminative training. If you're doing feature selection, if you're trying to go from 128 features down to 30 features, you can actually derive that reduction using a discriminative training process. Language models in speech recognition, the prior probability models, are trained in a discriminative way. So there's a lot of different things you can do. You can do adaptation of the model using discrimination. It's just now a general tool that can be applied to almost every aspect of a pattern recognition problem. And so, therefore, minimization of error in a closed-loop training paradigm is very powerful. And I think it's a technique which is applicable to most problems in pattern recognition. So hopefully you'll be able to make use of this in your work. So what we've done in this section of the course is to review basic concepts of entropy and mutual information. We then introduced two techniques for discriminative training, and then we talked a little bit about how these can be applied to many different aspects of the problem. Now, a key thing here to remember with discriminative training is that though it can give you a very good reduction in error rate, very often that reduction in error rate is related to the particular data set that you're using. So there is a problem with generalization because discriminatively trained models often, they do very well on a particular data set, but they often don't generalize to a new problem very well. So often you'll see people take these models and then have to retrain them for the new problem. So you could argue that you're getting better performance, but you're not really getting better generalization. And that's why you don't see them applied everywhere. Because in some applications, you cannot really control your operating environment. So in controlled environments, performance improvements are statistically significant. But the other interesting thing is that they're not overwhelmingly impressive. If you have an error rate of, let's say, 10%, it's not as though your error rate's going to go from 10% to 1% using discriminative training. It's more like your error rate's going to go from 10% to 9%, and you're going to spend, instead of spending a day of computing time, you're going to spend a year of computing time. Instead of spending 50 megabytes on model storage, you're going to spend a gigabyte on model storage. Or a terabyte, you know. So this was a great theoretical advance, but unfortunately in real-world problems like speech recognition, it did not produce the significant improvements that we thought it was going to. And that was really, I would say that's a big disappointment, because for many years it was thought this was the missing piece. So coming back to some discussions we've had throughout the semester, then it makes you wonder, what is it that humans do when they learn that's so much different than what we're doing statistically? Do humans do MLE training? Do humans do discriminative training? What is it that humans do that seems to be so much more powerful than what machines do? Because now we have the ability to do MLE and do generative and discriminative training, but apparently that neither of those is a complete solution. So that's just, I think, a little bit of philosophy. Okay. So I was actually looking at the syllabus over the weekend, and we're now in the last 2 weeks of the course, right? So, and we're pretty much on schedule. We're doing a pretty good job. But what I've been doing for the last few lectures is to introduce you to topics that are not really covered in the textbook, contemporary topics in pattern recognition. Some of these are very much leading edge research issues today. And so for the lectures this week, we're going to talk about several techniques that are very hot, you could say, hot in the research sense, but not in your their contemporary research topics. So about several years ago, one of the hot topics was particle filters. There were some seminal articles written in these in the IEEE Signal Processing Magazine. A lot of interest was generated. When I would go, I remember everyone was working on these at one time. And then later this week, I'll talk about a similar concept with machine learning, something called the packed Bayes bound. That's a very, very current, very hot topic in learning theory. So let's spend a few minutes today just sort of motivating this topic, and the next class we'll go through more of the details. Particle filtering is a sequential Monte Carlo methodology in which the relevant probability distributions are iteratively estimated using the concepts of important sampling and approximation of probability distributions with discrete random measures. Now, is there anyone in class that actually understands that statement? Sounds good, doesn't it? You read it and you say, well, that makes sense. But to really appreciate that, you need to know what important sampling is. You need to know what approximation of probabilities, what discrete random measures are, et cetera, right? So I was having a discussion about a week ago, a couple weeks ago, with someone working in the biology area on DNA sequencing. And they were telling me how important Monte Carlo methods have been to their research. And I was telling him how unimportant Monte Carlo methods are to my research, because if I want more data, I can essentially go and get it very easily. So the first thing we need to think about with particle filters is what happens when you have access to only limited amounts of data. There just is not a whole lot of data you can get your hands on. Now, give me an example from biology. So we've talked about with problems like speech recognition, just go and record speech. Or just go out on the internet and pull stuff off of YouTube. Suppose you're working in biology on DNA type problems. Where do you get your data from? What? Cells. Is it relatively easy to measure DNA of cells? You have to cut them, you know, you usually have to kill an animal, that's a problem sort of in itself. Then you have to take these things, prepare them, and throw them in some machine that images them and all this stuff. This is sort of the way we used to do speech research in the early days, when we would do very manual recordings under very controlled conditions, and we could only generate small amounts of data. Now, why is the amount of data so important to a problem like DNA? Would you say the DNA problem involves a small search space or a large search space? And I realize we haven't talked specifically about the problem, but you've all watched the newscasts and you've heard people talk about genomes and all this stuff. What's the fundamental problem in this area? Why is this probably the single hottest research area right now, and why is it that that this isn't a solved problem? So what is it? What is the general kind of hope with DNA? First of all, what are they trying to accomplish? What have they been trying to accomplish with the Human Genome Project and things like that? No, not they're right now. They're at the level where they're just trying to understand this language of DNA. Right? So they have a way of coding elements of human DNA, elements of animal DNA, and what they're finding is, to their surprise, and this was known long ago, but they've gotten much more precise about this. The number, the amount of DNA that's in common between us and animals is actually fairly high. Something like Only 2% of the DNA chain differs between us and, I think, monkeys or something like that. So they're building this, they're developing this language of DNA, and they're trying to understand how this varies from species to species. What makes a monkey and a human? How is that encoded in our DNA? Now, this, you can liken this to trying to learn a foreign language. You're dropped in some country, people are speaking something you don't understand, and what linguists do for a living is they learn how to understand a language that they've never heard before. And there's ways you can do that. There's nice techniques. And DNA is somewhat similar. They're trying to understand piece by piece what this language is all about and how you code different species. Well, they've made a lot of progress in that over the past few years. So now they're trying to take it one step further. The hope is that first they can understand, they can spot genetic components to diseases. If you're predisposed to having a certain disease, how does that show up in your DNA? And then, yes, they would also like to be able to manipulate it and in various ways to control disease and such. And so that, obviously, this is a fundamental research challenge. But one of the problems with this is that there just isn't a whole lot of data. There's not nearly, it's a very large search space. And I'm still learning about this, so I'm by no means an expert on this, but I'm trying to learn a little bit more about this problem to understand it. They claim the search space is very large. I'm not convinced the search space is that much larger than speech, but, you know, they haven't worked on speech. I haven't worked on their problem, so we don't really know. And we have people here at Mississippi State working in computer science department, for example, who are working extensively on this. But the other problem is they don't have enough data because it's very expensive to go and collect DNA samples. So they're only beginning to build large databases online. And if you think about, similar to the uniqueness of speakers that we've talked about in speech, there's so many species in the world. How long will it be before every animal species is codified? We understand their DNA. That could be a long time because there's more species. I don't know how many animal species there are. There's probably a billion or few million, maybe a few million different animal species in the world. And then the number of samples within each one of those species is very small. So one of the major advances in the last 10 years or so is getting human DNA online for a significant number of humans so that you can now begin to look at how it varies from human to human. But if the search space is so large, 10,000 samples, 100,000 samples is still very, very small. So they have a problem with data. Now, that was a long-winded explanation, but it's actually important to understanding why they want Monte Carlo methods. Monte Carlo methods are a way of studying a problem where you can use your models to generate more data, synthetic data, you could say, but it's data that's consistent with the statistics implied by your models, so that you can then take that data, that synthetic data, and operate on it and learn something useful about your actual problem space. So in a Monte Carlo approach, you will typically take a model of the data, use that model to generate more data, and then train on all that new data, and then iterate this process. And you hope that as your model gets better, the synthetic data gets better, your ability to learn about your problem space gets better, and you can just iterate and iterate until you get to the final solution. This is not unlike doing something like the following: taking speech data, training an HMM, using the HMM to generate more speech-like data, and then doing speech recognition on that synthetic data. So particle filtering is a technique that's deeply rooted in this concept of Monte Carlo methods. It's also very similar, in my view, to a technique we talked about early in the semester known as Parson windows, where we approximated a probability distribution using actual samples of that probability distribution. The earliest applications of sequential Monte Carlo methods were in the area of growing polymers, and they later expanded to other fields, including physics and engineering. Sequential Monte Carlo methods found limited use in the past, primarily due to their high computational complexity. Particle filtering is particularly useful in dealing with nonlinear and non-Gaussian problems. And that's one of the reasons it became a hot topic a few years ago, was it was an attempt to move beyond the Gaussian mixture models and hidden Markov models. They're usually used to estimate Bayesian models and are the sequential analog of Markov chain Monte Carlo batch methods. I don't expect you to understand that too much. They're often an alternative to an extended common filter or what's known as an uncentered common filter, with the advantage that with sufficient samples, they approach the Bayesian optimal estimate. These approaches can also be combined by using a version of the common filter as a proposal distribution for the particle filter. So that's a little bit about particle filters. We'll talk in more detail throughout this lecture. But in general, there are techniques, there are sampling-based techniques to try to estimate probability functions using actual estimates of those functions, much like we did with Parsons windows. Okay, we'll pick this up on Wednesday.